Hello, hi, welcome to the Travel Advice Show. I'm Chris Newton, and today we're going to be talking about Nepal and Bhutan. And we have a great guest today, and my co-host, Jerry Fuller. How you doing, Jerry?
Fantastic. How are you doing, Chris?
Oh, doing great. I'm excited about this topic, Nepal and Bhutan, but both amazing destinations. And would you like to introduce our guest, Jerry?
I would. I've known about Above the Cloud Travels for probably more than 20 years, and I've known Steve for probably 15, 17 years, and I've even used him for my trips to Nepal, and he's phenomenal. And Steve, we're excited to have you here today.
Yeah.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Yeah.
Well, to begin with, I wanted to ask a question, and I know at Travel Advice, we get this a lot, and I know there's confusion. On the terms, is it Himalaya, Himalayas, or Himalayan, or is it all of them?
Well, I've seen all of them in use. The proper term would be Himalaya, singular. It looks singular to us, but Himalaya is actually a plural word in Sanskrit. It means the abode of the snow. Himalayas is how it usually gets written here, and in the UK you usually hear it pronounced Himalayas. So you could say all of the above, but being a purist, I always say Himalaya.
Okay, fantastic. And Steve, is there a better time to go, or is there a best time to go, and why?
The main thing to be aware of there is the summer monsoon, which begins sometime in early June and peters out sometime in mid-September to late September. That's a time you generally want to avoid for trekking. Some people will go for cultural tours and such, but you're still going to get wet, and you're dealing with things like leeches on the trails, and lots of stomach ailments abound. So it's generally a good time to avoid from early June to mid-September. The popular seasons for trekking are fall and spring, mainly because you've got little or no precipitation, rain or snow, and you've got pretty clear skies in the fall, reasonably clear skies in the spring, although there tend to be a few more clouds in the spring than in the fall. And the nighttime lows will generally stay in the 20s or higher in the high country. The winter is not a bad time to be there in terms of atmospheric clarity. You have cloud-free skies most of the time, but you have to limit your treks to, say, 10,000 feet or so, unless you're really an adventurer and have a serious, like, polar sleeping bag. Don't mind temperatures below zero Fahrenheit. So that's pretty much how it works out weather-wise. The fall is more busy in terms of trekking traffic on the trails. And so if people are looking to avoid the crowds, they should either try to go early or late fall, early or late spring, or go to a trail that's not very much in use, and there are plenty of those.
Okay. Let me ask this. Is there a minimum age that you like to take and a maximum age? Or is that a part of the situation to worry about?
Age is really not that much of a factor. Certainly, most people are going to be, we'll say, 25 or older, just because of the economic necessities involved in traveling that far. And one thing I learned early on in this that was kind of interesting to me was that the people who tend to have problems are usually, let's say, 35 and under, as opposed to 60 and over.
Oh, really?
Is there
a reason? And that's got more to do with probably maturity than anything else, because younger people who are perhaps more prone to pushing themselves and testing their limits find that pushing your limits when you're at altitude really aren't helpful in terms of avoiding altitude illness. And older people who generally have a lot of experience in the mountains are past the point of trying to test their limits and seeing just how far they can push themselves. They have a pretty realistic sense of what they can do, and they're not looking to bite off more than they can chew.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Now, I want to ask a couple of more questions, and I want you to really go into detail on the area, because you know it so well and been there for many, many years and many, many times. We were talking about Nepal and Bhutan and about trekking, and you mentioned about less travel treks and more travel treks. Are there areas of both countries that you think, if you've never been, that you really should trek your first time?
That's a good question. In Nepal, for example, where prior to the recent political unrest, they were getting well over 100,000 trekkers a year.
Wow.
Wow, that's amazing.
Most of that traffic was on two trails, the Everest and Annapurna areas. And the Everest area has continued to do well throughout the political turmoil because it has not been affected by the Maoist insurgency really in any way. And so people have been able to trek up there without any concerns about being encountered by a group of Maoists.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say if someone were really interested in just seeing the most impressive peaks, and they weren't looking to be exposed to a very untouched traditional cultural environment, you'd be hard-pressed to improve on the Everest area. Interestingly, Everest would not be the most impressive mountain that you would see up there. It certainly is the highest, as we all know, but if you were to put it in a lineup with nine other randomly chosen Himalayan peaks in a beauty contest, it would probably never make the five finalists. So, you know, it's wonderful that it's the highest mountain in the world, and it's impressive to see, but there are peaks that one would see on the way into Everest that are more impressive, Ama de Blam being the most famous. So for sheer mountain grandeur, you'd be hard-pressed to improve on trekking in the Everest area.
Okay.
As far as... Go ahead.
Well, while we're talking about that, and then please continue right where you were. But so are you sort of saying that an option, a viable option, would be to maybe like take the one-hour Buddha Everest and the mountain tour that you fly right out of Kathmandu and come back and see Everest that way, mainly because you can see it from Kathmandu in many places. But do you recommend maybe doing that and then taking another trail that would have better mountains?
Well, in Nepal at present, you have to factor in the political instability.
All right.
So we have specialized over the past 25 years in taking people into areas where, in many cases, we could virtually guarantee that not only would they see no other trekkers the whole time they're out, but they would also be meeting villagers in places where they had a real sense that the inroads of the outside world were negligible at best.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really was an opportunity to time travel and spend time over a period of weeks amongst people who were living in ways that really had not changed much over the centuries. Those areas have been heavily infiltrated over the last 6 or 7 years by the Maoist insurgents. And even though the Maoists have not really done physical harm to tourists or trekkers, many trekkers just don't want to be looking over their shoulder, wondering if there were Maoists behind that bush coming to meet them. And I mean, it's from a trekker standpoint, certainly not from a Nepali standpoint, but from a trekker standpoint, the situation is slightly comical once you get past the $120 donation that you're expected to make. Because after they shake you down for the $120, actually it's a little bit more now that the dollar has suffered, 10,000 rupees is their standard fee per trekker. They give you a written receipt, and if you encounter any other groups of Maoists on the trail, you simply show them your receipt and essentially say, I gave it the office, and they give you a big namaste and smile and wave you on your way. So even though there was no serious threat to physical safety, I would say the majority of trekkers wouldn't be comfortable with the thought that there are Maoists lurking up there on the trail. And so we've pretty much stuck to two itineraries in Nepal for the last 5 or 6 years, one being the Everest area, the other being an area called Mustang, which is spelled like the sports car, but pronounced Mustang. Mm. And that's the other area in Nepal that has been unimpacted by any Maoist presence or activity.
Where is that located?
It's in north of Annapurna. And so for people doing the very popular Annapurna circuit, which was getting upwards of 80,000 trekkers a year at its peak in the late 90s, believe it or not, it really begins at the turnaround point of the Annapurna trek and heads north up towards the Tibetan border. And this is an area that was totally sealed off to the outside world until 1992. And at that point, they started allowing trekking groups in there. They did decide that they were going to copy the Bhutan model, if you will, and impose a special permit fee, which is $700 per trekker for your first 10 days up there, and $70 a day after that.
Wow.
So it's a little bit more expensive than going to any other part of Nepal. But for that extra price, you get to visit a world that was truly sealed off to the outside world until just 15 years ago and still gets only about 1,000 visitors a year compared to, we'll say, oh, maybe 30,000 to 40,000 a year now in the Everest area. So you're going to see far fewer trekkers, and the impact up there is only 15 years old as opposed to, oh, say, 60 years old in the Everest area.
Hey, Steve, I have a question. Just when you're mentioning the numbers of the people trekking, is there any guidelines that Nepal and Bhutan are taking to try to make it sustainable, you know, to try to, limit the amount of trekkers to, you know, is that damaging the area if there's so many people on one trail, or is it?
Well, that's a great point. Nepal has adopted the more the merrier approach from the beginning. And so I would say there was not much thought put into it other than, well, I guess they're coming, so, you know, we'll make hay while the sun shines.
Yeah, right.
And I think they're probably paying the price in many ways because of that. I think that the biggest problems that I've seen were in the Annapurna area. When I first trekked there in 72, they issued about 600 trek permits. By 1982, the number was up over 10,000. And by the early 90s, it was over 50,000. And the problem became that with that sudden and dramatic increase in the number of visitors coming through, everybody's lives had to be rearranged around that. And so people who had been farmers for many, many generations were giving that up to get involved in the hospitality industry, whether it's innkeepers or porters or guides, etc. And as a result, when the bottom fell out around 2000 due to their own local political problems, as well as 9/11 and the Royal Massacre in Kathmandu in June of 2001, suddenly these people couldn't go back to farming or didn't want to go back to farming, and yet their newfound occupation was suffering badly. And so that's the kind of, that's one of the prices. Cultural dislocation really became, I think, the main problem. Cultural identity was really jeopardized. The Everest area, the buildup was slower, and they seem to have weathered the storm a lot more successfully. And as you go through the Everest area, you will certainly see signs of exposure to the outside world. I mean, Namche Bazaar, which is 10 days walk from the nearest road, has telephone service. Back even in the late 90s, I recall going into one lodge, and they had a full-size pool table set up. And the local Sherpas with their ponytails had their long neck beers on the side of the pool table, and Bob Dylan and Bob Marley were playing in the background. And I learned that they had flown the pool table in by helicopter. So, you know, you will see things that and you know, the local people might be wearing the latest Patagonia and Nike and high-tech gear, but they have still kept one foot very firmly planted in their Sherpa world, and they know who they are, and they're proud of being Sherpa. So they've done a little bit better, I would say, than the people in the Annapurna area. Bhutan, on the other hand, has taken a very proactive stance from the very beginning. When tourism opened in Nepal, they were tightly sealed off to the world. And when they finally decided to open their country to visitors in 1974, which was when the recent king was crowned, they did so on a very careful, well thought out, step-by-step basis. And there's a lot of misconception that they actually limit the number of guests that come in, and that's not really accurate. They use the price mechanism to regulate the faucet. And so if they felt that there were too many tourists coming in last year, they have a set per-day price, which presently is $200 per person per night, that you have to pay to the government to come in. And they would raise that price or lower that price depending on whether they thought they needed fewer or more visitors next year. And up until 2005, the most visitors they ever had in a year was 7,500.
Fabulous.
In 2006, they had over 17,000. And part of that is that they had kept that $200 per diem the same since 1987, which was the last time they had changed it. And in 1987, $200 per night seemed pretty expensive, and it was, but by 2006, that same price was no longer nearly as steep. Another factor was they traded in their Boeing aerospace jets, which carried 72 passengers, for two Airbus short takeoff and landing jets, which carry 124 passengers each.
Okay.
So their capacity to bring people in and out went up almost double. The number of lodges that was built in the country increased, and so they saw a more than doubling of their previous record in 1 year, and they're feeling the effect of that somewhat. But when you compare 17,000 in Bhutan to Nepal was getting over 300,000 tourists at one point a year, it's really pretty minimal.
Okay, interesting.
And the reason that the Bhutanese government did that was they certainly saw the plus side of having hard currency to spend, which guests would leave behind, but they weren't going to do that at the expense of either their natural environment or their culture, their traditional culture. And one thing interesting about Bhutan, the country is 72% forested, and it's one of only two countries in the world where the amount of land under forest cover is increasing.
Oh, wow. Wow, nice.
So they're very, very serious about protecting what they've got, both their natural environment and their cultural environment.
Let me ask this question while we're talking about Bhutan. I know Nepal and Bhutan, I've been to both several times, numerous times, are very Buddhist. Now, I know at one stage in Bhutan, women were not allowed even really close to some of the temples, monasteries, etc. Are they more relaxed now for women touring Bhutan and doing more of the things that men had more freedom to do?
There were periods where many of the monasteries were off limits. And again, it was for the same reason. I expect they probably had some incidents where visitors might have not been very sensitive to the ceremonies that might have been going on. And certainly you can, we all have experiences where we've seen people treating the locals like, you know, they're on display or their only purpose in being there is for our enjoyment. So I'm sure that there were some experiences that may have caused them to do that. But they always take a very common sense approach. And at present, the only places that are off limits are a couple of temples and monasteries that are really very sacred to them because they're at the heart of their historical and spiritual heritage. And other than that, if you have an itinerary in advance and it's set up to include a visit to a particular monastery, the agent in Bhutan may have to go and get permission to have you visit on that particular day, and they will pay an entrance fee, all of which is included in whatever you pay the government there. But for the most part, the country is open.
Well, let me ask you a question while we're on Bhutan, because you hear the word, and I'll just spell it because I want you to pronounce it for us, and you see the word all over Bhutan, the D-Z-O-N-G. Would you tell us how to correctly pronounce that, and what is a D-Z-O-N-G?
Ah, Zong. Okay, that's a good question. In the beginning, long ago in Bhutan, several centuries ago, their main concern was their security vis-a-vis would-be Tibetan invaders or marauders. And so they built these large fortresses that were well-suited to protect the passes and the valleys where invading armies from Tibet could be stopped. Over time, the monks established themselves within these well-protected fortresses, so they began to serve a double purpose as a fortress and a monastery, and Zong is commonly translated as fortress slash monastery because it served both purposes. Today, of course, invading armies from Tibet, well, at least for now anyway, are not an issue. And so and Bhutan's defense is really very much taken care of by the Indian Army. So the Zong is strictly a monastery today, but it still translates as fortress monastery.
All right.
And the other interesting thing that comes out of that is the national sport in Bhutan is archery.
Really?
And that devolves directly from that. In those olden days, one of the first lines of defense was your archery skills. And they became very proficient at archery. And especially during festival times in Bhutan, you will see people out taking part in these archery contests. And the target is a little bit further than the goalposts on a football field.
Wow.
And the bullseye is about the size of a silver dollar, maybe just slightly larger. And invariably, you'll see one or two people hit that bullseye from that distance, and it's really remarkable. It's a wonderful event to see. And when I asked them, I know you participate in the Olympics in archery, but you never do very well, and I'm surprised by that. Why is it? And the answer I always hear is, in the Olympics, the targets are too close.
Oh.
That's good.
That's fabulous. I want to ask you another question about Bhutan, because everyone's image of Bhutan is the super high, magnificently beautiful mountains and the narrow, winding valleys and the monasteries on the cliffs and things on that nature. But other parts of Bhutan are different than that, aren't they? You want to talk about the different areas of Bhutan a little bit?
Yes. I mean, Bhutan really has just one road that goes from the west central border at Paro, straight across the middle of the country from west to east, almost to the very eastern border with the Arunachal Pradesh province of India. And then from that road in the far east and far west, you've got roads down to the Indian border, which are the main avenues of transport for goods to and from India. And so when you arrive in Bhutan, 98% of people arrive in Bhutan by plane to the only airport, which is Paro in that far western corner. The capital of Thimphu is now only an hour and a half or two distant by road, on a beautiful road, and the vehicles are all late model, Japanese and Korean make. There's no black particulate matter spewing out the tailpipe, and the drivers drive fairly courteously, which in that part of the world is a bit of a surprise. So most people will visit Paro and Thimphu, And if they're there for a week, they will probably go over the pass east of Thimphu to the Punaka Valley. And that's all that they will see of Bhutan. And I would say that's probably over half the visitors to Bhutan will see no more than that. If you're trekking, again, three quarters of the trekkers go on one trail, which I used to refer to as sort of the Annapurna of Bhutan, and that's the Chomalhari trek. And it goes from Paro and ends in Thimphu, or vice versa. It's a loop. And that was the first trek I did in Bhutan, and it's a beautiful trek. But the two downsides to it are that the window for trekking in Bhutan is narrower than Nepal because of the altitude and the monsoon dragging on later. And so the limited traffic you do have is all cramped into one small window, and you're always bumping into other trekkers.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem I always had with it was that there are, after the first day, there are virtually no villages along the route. And so it's a beautiful wilderness experience, but for me, the beauty of trekking in the Himalaya is that you've got beautiful mountains with wonderful culture. And on that trek, you really don't have much interaction with the culture because you're in the wilderness for most of the time. So we've done some other treks out of Punaka and a valley even further east called Bumtang, where as soon as you go up into the mountains, you're going into villages that see much less in the way of trekking traffic. And you do have more villages along the route to go with the mountain experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask this. On that trek, I know that most of the treks in Bhutan are long. And I don't mean by super long, but they're longer than some of the treks in Nepal. Is that because you have to go a longer distance to get to, say, another road to get back, or you have to? Is there a reason why some of them are like 10, 12, or days
longer? Yeah, you brought up a good point. You would think that trekking in Nepal and trekking in Bhutan would be fairly similar, and yet there are some distinct differences. Treks in Bhutan tend to be longer, and that is mostly because there are no internal airstrips that you can fly to like you have in Nepal. And in Nepal, you can start your trek closer to the peaks. You don't have to walk in. In Bhutan, you're always walking in, and you don't have as quick, easy access as you do in Nepal, with some exceptions. The other thing in Bhutan that I would say is the days tend to be longer.
Is that because
trails,
you walk longer, or is there more daylight?
Well, they began their trekking industry with just the Chomalhari trek. They had some short treks further away from the mountains, but their first and only real inner mountain trek was the Chomalhari trek. And when they set that up, my partner in Bhutan actually went out to put the camps in place. They were going to have set camps along the route. And at each camp, they built a large stone hut, which would be shelter from the elements for the trekkers, and a place to be out of the elements and have your dinner and feel a little bit cozy and protected. And he knew that Westerners couldn't trek at the same level as the Bhutanese, so he walked a half a day rather than a full day and put the camps there.
Oh, okay.
Well, a Bhutanese half a day is a real full day for most trekkers.
Mm-hmm.
And in Nepal, an average day on the trail is 6.5 to 7 hours.
Okay.
In Bhutan, it's more like 8 to 8.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And some days are even a little bit longer than that. Furthermore, Bhutan, the mountains seem to be steeper for on average,
mm-hmm.
and so the up and down can be more painful.
Mm-hmm.
And further adding to that is it gets considerably more rain in the monsoon than Nepal does, because the monsoon comes through Bhutan into Nepal and retreats the same way. And Bhutan probably gets an extra 60 inches of rain a year over Nepal.
Wow.
And early in the fall,
green, isn't it? Okay.
This can make for some really muddy trails.
Yes.
And if you're having to extricate your foot from the mud every time you place your foot on the trail, you're spending about 3 times the energy that you would normally be spending if you were walking on a nice dry trail.
Mm-hmm.
So trekking in Bhutan tends to be a more serious affair, and it varies from trek to trek, but on average, certainly, you can get beat up a lot better on a trek in Bhutan than in Nepal.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask another. I want two more questions. I know we're taking a lot of your time, and we're thrilled that you're talking about this, but there are two questions I really want to talk about. One of them, which is one of my favorites, is whitewater rafting. And I know Nepal does quite a bit. Do they also have kayaking with real whitewater kayaks? And can you talk about the whitewater rafting? Do you recommend it when people go there? If so, is there a time of year you have to do it because the water is better or worse? Maybe not quite as bad. And you like it more than one day, or do you recommend it at all?
You're talking about kayaking?
And whitewater rafting.
And whitewater rafting.
And kayaking.
Rafting is certainly more popular than kayaking, and it's much more established in Nepal, where it's a very common piece of the overall experience there. A lot of people will do a trek, rafting, elephant safari kind of combo trip. I've done a fair bit of rafting in Nepal. My main reservations about it are, number one, your back is always to the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you turn around, you can't see the mountains. So it's not a mountain experience at all. But the real issue for me is that the number of rivers that are open is relatively few. There are a few that have been developed in the far west, for example, where you can no longer go because of the Maoists. But along the river where 95% of the traffic goes, the villages there have been heavily impacted, much the way Annapurna was with trekking traffic. And so I really don't like when kids come into camp begging and things like that. And so it's not what I would call a pristine experience.
Right.
Kayaking, especially I think if you're doing it on a day trip basis or you're doing it for the love of kayaking on a class 4 type river, I think that's a more appealing experience. But I don't, I'm sure there are a couple of agents in Kathmandu that specifically focus on that, and I think that would probably be an enjoyable experience just because the water is pretty powerful coming out of those mountains.
Oh, I know.
In Bhutan, it's very much in its infancy. We do one rafting program in the Punakha Valley for about a half a day, but it's class 1 and class 2 rapids.
Mm-hmm.
And they've tried to do more serious things, and I've not seen that continue over time. I think they were trying that about 10, 12 years ago, and I haven't really seen it continue. So I think if you were looking for water-based sports, Nepal is your better bet, and I think kayaking is probably more of a thrill than the rafting is.
Right. Well, then I have just one more question I want to ask. And basically, if you were going to go to that part of the world, Nepal and Bhutan, and you'd never been, and you wanted to get a great combination of cultural, scenic, and just overall ambient feel and experience, how long did you stay, and what is a basic itinerary, taking into consideration, let's just say, the average person that has some skills and abilities to trek, and not super athletic, but is there a recommended itinerary? Because I know you really should see both countries, because they're different, but they're similar. And what would you recommend? Your first time there, what would you do and how long would you stay?
I would say if somebody wants, you should always approach a first-time trip, in my opinion, like it's going to be a once-in-a-lifetime trip, and not as part one of future adventures, although it often turns into that. So you should plan to do it right the first time. And because of how far you have to travel physically to get there, it's typically day three when you arrive. And because of the adjustment you've got to make, both in terms of jet lag and, more importantly, culturally, to begin to really feel that you're able to plug into that world and that environment, I think minimum of 2 weeks is essential. And if you're looking to do a good trek, I would say a 3 week trip door to door, which means you might be spending about 2 weeks on trek, is really the standard. Okay. The reason for that being, when you first hit the trail, your mind is still working at local speed back here, which I call 60 miles an hour. And local speed there is 3 miles an hour. And it's going to take you a while to begin to shift down to where you can get to a point where you're on a similar wavelength to the people there and can begin to understand their world so that it's no longer exotic and quaint and different. And my objective in bringing people to that part of the world has always been that they would come away with their world having been enriched by understanding on a real gut level why these people live such a contented life despite really hard conditions. And that's the thing that really grabs people a lot. I mean, I hear people say over and over on the second or third day of the trek, if these people have so little, how come they're so damn happy all the time? And I want people to come away with some gut-level feeling of why that is. And if you're there, if you're out on trek for 2 weeks, you can come away with more than just an intellectual answer to that. And in that scenario, it's something that you can then incorporate into your own life. As you get into a stressful situation or you're having a stressed out day, you can think back to these people and go, these people have to deal with landslides and monsoons and all kinds of unbelievable conditions, and they go through it with a smile on their face, and they're so relaxed. I should be able to do that. So if you're looking at it from that perspective, I think 3 weeks door-to-door and 2 weeks on trek gives you a chance to come back with something like that.
That's great. Fantastic. Yeah, I like the 3 miles per hour speed. That's a good speed.
Yeah, I mean, and when you're there, and I know you've been there, you know, you can see that they're working on a different speed and a different wavelength than we are.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, we thank you very, very much. Would you give us how to contact Above the Clouds?
Yes, the easiest ways to reach us are either by phone. We have a toll-free number, which is 800-233-4499. And people can also first check out our website, which is www.aboveclouds.com. That's aboveclouds with no the, .com.
All right.
Fabulous.
All right, great.
Well, Steve, again, thank you so very much. This has been very enlightening, interesting, and we do appreciate you being on with us.